Today, we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Oh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
The Last Word on Today FM.
Now, our next guest has been in the studio previously when he was Minister for Housing. That was a few years ago because he left that position when the new government was formed in 2020. And then a year later, he suddenly upped and quit and didn't just leave politics, but he left the country. And he has written a book about it called Running From Office, Confessions of Ambition and Failure in Politics. Owen Murphy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Not only did you quit politics, you quit the country. Were you that disillusioned?
I mean, it was. I suppose I was, yes, that disillusioned, but also I was upset with myself for how I'd performed in my job and upset with myself for how I hadn't managed certain things. But also I was getting a lot of pressure in the streets, unwanted attention, even when I was no longer the housing minister. And, you know,
Did you deserve it, though?
For some people, sure. You know, I mean, you're the politician, you're responsible. You don't understand why they're saying or doing the things they're doing because I didn't manage certain parts of the job very well and they want to express that. So I get that feeling. I get it myself when I watch politicians on TV and I start giving out to them and then I catch myself and go, Owen, hold on a second, mate. You were in that position yourself and you hated it. So, you know, try and be a bit fair. So yes, it's totally understandable if even someone like myself who's been on the receiving end can be that way. But I wasn't able to kind of really manage that stuff. And I'd also, my political career hadn't gone the way I'd wanted it to go. And I knew if I was to properly get some space to reflect on the whole thing, I needed to get the hell out of here. So I did.
And then why revisit it all with a book? I mean, is this a pity party?
Not at all. No, not at all. I mean, for me, it began as an exploration of, look, what went wrong? You know, how do I understand for myself personally, when I started out with idealism and ambition and I thought things were going to go so well and I'd be a really great minister for housing. And then that didn't happen. And I needed to kind of excavate that myself. And as I did, while it was very cathartic, I thought, look, there might be some insights here. So while this is a story about me, I wanted to be more about kind of lifting the curtain on how politics really works and what the people are like in there. And I just thought if I did that with a kind of a brute force of honesty, it might make it more accessible to the people who wouldn't maybe typically read these books. I'm sure you read a lot of political books.
I do.
A lot of them are kind of hard to get through because they go too much into policy or they go too much into politics, people running old races that they lost. And I just thought, well, if I don't care so much about that because I'm not trying to prove anything that I had done, if I just accept that people weren't happy, maybe there were good reasons, let's find out what they are. And so I start writing from that point of view in a way that hopefully is enjoyable so that it brings them to those some of those lessons I'm trying to kind of, not lessons, I mean, insights, I suppose, into political life.
It comes from the title as well because of one dramatic incident while you were the housing minister. But it's quite clear that this job seriously affected your mental health. You had, to all intents and purposes, a breakdown on the job.
Yeah, it broke me. It did. And I still find it difficult to talk about it. And even my therapist gives out to me for maybe evading the proper language sometimes. I talk about panic attacks. I talk about crises of confidence. But essentially, after the first motion of no confidence, and I had to, but after the first one, I let all the kind of pressure of the moment and the pressure of the criticism get to me. I let it bite too hard and I didn't manage my health, my mental health well. And it all kind of came down on top of me in London, December of 2018, when I physically ran through the streets of London in the middle of the night. It was raining. I was panicking. I was crying. I was desperate to get out of my job. And I recovered from that, but it scared the hell out of me because I had lost control. Not completely. I had still some degree of self-awareness that I was acting strangely, oddly, you know. But from that point on, then I was worried it might happen again. I was worried I would lose complete touch with myself. And I had a battle then of trying to get out of the job. And then when that failed, trying to recompose myself in the job so I could continue on until I could get out.
Because you were seriously considering quitting in early 2019.
I put together an exit committee when the homeless figures reached 10,000 of some close people to me. I put the plans in place. I knew what I was going to say. All I had the timing perfectly. right before the Easter holidays. And I was just waiting for that chance to get to Leo and go, right, I'm doing this. Here's my resignation. And I'm sorry, but goodbye. An event in my private life, my personal life, intervened, which in one respect put things in perspective. And in another respect, actually, because I then was consumed with that, I missed my window to resign. So as I came through that time, all of a sudden I'm like, right, I'm not able to resign now because it's going to be too damaging for everyone politically. If the housing minister, who's, you know, being so criticized for things and maybe rightly so, with all these politicians going to the local elections, I just couldn't do it. And then I was like, right, well, if I'm staying, I've got to build myself back up again. And again, with the title, running was a big key to that in terms of.
Yeah, but you know, there'd be people listening to this who will be saying, it's a pity you didn't actually resign at the time. And sure. You effectively, you fought two no confidence motions mm-hmm. brought by the opposition against you. And the irony is, you had no confidence in yourself.
Yeah, I know, right? So there was like a loss of confidence. You start to doubt yourself. You then kind of pity yourself, and then you kind of hate yourself for pitying yourself. You go through this whole range of emotions. I hit the drink hard, really recklessly. And then after that, I kind of picked myself up and realized that I was kind of ashamed of how I'd been behaving. And I wanted to try and at least steady the ship before I left and try and leave, not in a complete panic. And in doing that, though, I kind of got myself back into the job properly. There were things I've been working on. Some of them started to come good. Some of the numbers that I used to always talk about, and it used to really annoy people, but these kind of fundamental things around plannings and buildings were starting to come good. And that gave me a bit of confidence again. I moved back into, I'd been in the inner circle. I'd been right at the center of government. I'd been pushed out. I was being brought back in. That helped with my confidence. But then other things come along, like another motion of no confidence, and you're going, Christ, have I got the energy to fight a second motion of no confidence? When fighting the first one, which I'd won, I felt really damaged me. And so you kind of steel yourself for that. You get through it. And then an election's happening, you know?
4 years since you left the job, homelessness numbers are higher than they ever were under your watch. So does that make you feel that maybe you didn't do as badly as you thought at the time?
I made the mistakes that I made. And it's almost separate to, you know, like, it's terrible that homelessness hasn't improved, because we really believed that we were putting fundamental things in place that would improve the situation. We worried at a particular point in time that actually doing things like increasing supply of social housing wasn't, you know, we worried that homelessness had decoupled from that, you know, because the idea is people are homeless because they need support from the state to live, or they're on a housing list. If we build more homes, the homeless numbers should come down. I mean, that was part of the thinking, not all of it. And then we worried at a point that maybe the numbers had decoupled, that actually building more housing wasn't actually going to fix the homeless crisis, and something else was happening. And then in COVID, things then changed again, because all of a sudden we had to kind of change our thinking around protecting people immediately. But I really worried that in some of the emergency measures that we had to put in place for COVID, that when they were lifted, then they would overwhelm the system. I don't know if that's happened, because I'm not involved anymore, unfortunately. So I don't live in the country. I haven't been paying enough attention to know what's actually happened. But I can say that at the time of COVID, we worried that because we were doing things like freezing rents to protect people, I mean, there was a good reason at the time, and freezing evictions, that actually when that period ended, the system that was in place maybe might not be able to respond to then a large increase in people then presenting again.
Before you became housing minister, in the aftermath of the crash, a couple of really major decisions were made by your predecessors, which I suspect weren't really fully debated at the time, and people may not necessarily have understood what was involved, because people thought, we don't need to build houses and we don't need to build apartments. So there are two elements to it. And the first one I want to ask about is this desire to get people to live in apartments mm-hmm. rather than houses. Mm-hmm. Does that fit what Irish people want? Or is it actually just something that we have to do because it's the European way for environmental reasons? And actually, the people coming into the country have probably grown up in apartments and might be quite happy to live in them here in Ireland.
Yeah, like it's definitely what we need. Whether it's what we want as individuals, that's different, but it's what we need. I mean, I think 1 in 2 people on the housing lists are single adults, you know, and we can't build a house for every single adult. We have to build apartments for them. And that was
one bedroom apartment sufficient.
You know, for some people, one bedroom apartment will be what they need for that, you know, point in their life. It's not sufficient for everyone. The important point that I was always trying to make at the time, and I don't want to really get back into policy stuff, but was to have a proper mix. And when I got into the role, I felt there wasn't a proper mix of what was being built, whether it was houses or one beds or family apartments, and was to try and drive supply in lots of areas. But like it was challenging for lots of reasons. It was challenging because I made some mistakes early on that, you know, had I not made them, perhaps things might have moved a bit more quickly, or at least if they didn't move more quickly, people might have had more faith in what I was trying to do.
And allied to that, co-living was something that you championed. Yeah. And you regret that now, do you?
Do I regret it? I mean, it'd be crazy if I didn't regret it, right? Because it became this just touchstone issue for so many people who didn't understand what I was trying to do. And when they heard this co-living plan, they thought that was my solution
explain
to the housing
it. Crisis. Explain it again for people who might not be familiar with it.
Basically, it's like almost like landing accommodation for a professional arriving in a new city. So as I had seen it, you move to somewhere like London, you've got a job, you've got no place to live, you don't want to commit to living in a house with people you don't know yet, or you can't find a flat yet. So you move into somewhere for 3 or 6 months where you have your own ensuite bedroom and there's communal spaces and that kind of stuff.
Sort of like post-student digs, is it?
Look, every time I've tried to describe it, I've put my foot in my mouth and then I've, you know, been carried out of the building and then had all my colleagues thanking me for talking about co-living again. And you know, it was something I was trying to introduce as a part of the solution. And it was absolutely ignored by everyone when I did introduce it because I thought, yeah, that's nothing. And then a planning application landed. I mean, I can tell you just if I've got the time, a planning application landed for the first co-living development. And it was a bad planning application. I couldn't come out and say that because I was the Minister for Planning, so it would be like a judge kind of prejudging a case before it had begun. And then people wrote some articles. One person wrote an article about me, just basically completely trashing me. I was in a negative space. I took it very personally. So instead of kind of just going for a quiet run in London in the middle of the night, I instead decided to go out and defend co-living as a concept. But it sounded like I was defending the plan, this particular plan for this particularly bad version of it. And that's when it blew up. And that was absolutely my mistake. And I was talking about co-living for the rest of my tenure. And I'd ask my advisors, why does this keep on coming up? And they're like, because of you, you idiot. You know, I mean, they didn't say it that directly, obviously, but, you know, their eyes.
As it happens, one of the major problems with it is that some developers have made out like bandits in relation to the prices that they've been charging to people. Having made promises that they would charge X, they, when the buildings opened, started charging X plus 50, X plus 100%. But we won't go into that now. The other thing, I suppose, that again started to happen before you became Minister for Housing, but accelerated during your time in charge, was the cuckoos or the vultures or whatever names you want to give to the institutional investors who were funding the construction of apartment blocks. And this goes back to government policy from before your time, this belief that we needed this international money to provide the accommodation rather than the banks financing builders and developers. So did we go too far in that? Or is it that we actually still need that? That if we're going to get apartments built, we actually need this institutional investment money, which then becomes these big landlords at high rents?
Well, so the rules around financing for house building and apartment building changed following the crash. And certainly some companies took advantage of some of the tax planning that was there, tax loopholes, and they came in. And I think Michael Noonan moved to close a few of them, if I remember correctly. But I mean, I just got back into the country 2 days ago and I see apartments coming up, you know, all over the place. Down by Clanagale, down in Ringsend, in my own constituency, that whole poolbag. I mean, lots of cranes, lots of apartments being built. I see new apartments in different parts of the city. So something is working right now to get those apartments built. I don't know who's funding them. I don't know if it is foreign money or if it's Irish money. I don't know. But it's good to see that we're actually getting more built, you know, in a, like you were saying earlier, in a kind of compact way, close to where there are services. People don't have to travel long distances. And they can, you know, keep the city vibrant and keep it living.
Did you say my own constituency or old constituency?
Old Christ. if I said own, I've got to leave again very quickly. Old constituency. Yeah. I'm not, you know, this book, Matt, isn't about me trying to come back and be a commentator or get back into politics. Not at all. I see it as a kind of final contribution. There may be something from my experience that might be of interest to other people. And here it is in a book.
Do you see yourself as an exile now who might only come back occasionally to visit friends and family?
Well, that's all I do. I mean, because I don't work here, I work abroad. So my base is in London and I like living there very much.
Is it cheaper to live in London than it would be to live in Dublin?
No, I got a coffee. Coffees here have gone crazy and so have, you know, burritos of all things have gone bananas.
But housing is the big cost.
No, yeah, but I'm just like the cost of living stuff I was just surprised by. you know, housing, the cost of living in London in terms of accommodation is something else entirely. But luckily, transport's very good. So you can live not in the city centre, but be in the city centre very quickly on a couple of tube journeys. But what I loved about London, or what I love about London, is like certainly having, you know, being at the kind of centre of public life here for a while, it was nice to be able to go there and get a bit of anonymity and use that as a way of kind of getting back to myself, where I'd feel comfortable being in public. And I'd feel that if, you know, people weren't about to come up and maybe, you know, give me abuse, because unfortunately I took a lot of that very personally and I shouldn't have.
If you're giving out about the price of a cup of coffee or a burrito in Dublin, could that type of thing work against the government in the forthcoming general election, you think? Like in America, it seems that inflation and the economy was one of the big things, that a cost of living crisis here in Ireland is the type of thing that will undermine a government in an election.
I couldn't tell you, Matt, because I haven't been here. Sorry, I've just, like, of course I'm going to avoid that question. I have no interest in being involved in politics anymore. I just spent 2 months in Tbilisi, Georgia, observing their elections. And I just arrived in here and I'm kind of looking around and seeing what's going on. And even if I had an opinion, it wouldn't be worth anything.
Well, I am going to ask you one other political related question in that regard, though. But would Eoin O'Brien, who marked you as opposition spokesman for Sinn Féin, make a good housing minister? Do you think, would he do a better job than you did?
Good question. I mean, he marked me and beat me, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think maybe for the first part of my time as a minister, I was able to kind of match him, but I just, in terms of communicating what we were trying to do, I lost him on that big time. In the book, I talk about things that aren't about Fine Gael government. It's not about Fine Gael government. It's about what happens when you're in government, when your party's in government, and you're the government and they're the opposition, and what happens to you as an individual when you're one of 15 ministers around a cabinet table, and each minister has their own thing to worry about, their own priorities, so do their civil servants, and you're trying to get your things through. It's a challenge you can't really know until you're in it and how you'll face it. It's far more complex than dealing with the opposition. It's much easier to be opposition and criticize government, or government to kick back at opposition. What's much more difficult than both those scenarios is actually being in government and trying to get the machine of state working for you.
If you were out of your depth as a government minister, how many other ministers do you suspect were out of their depth but just managed to mask it?
If I was out of my depth as a government minister, Matt, that's a, you know, I had a tough time as a minister. I think I did some good things.
I'm not saying
you
didn't,
but right? But I clearly didn't handle it, manage the brief well, and manage myself well in the brief. And this book is about me.
But the question is pertinent in that you've admitted this. You've set out.
Yeah, but how could I possibly know? Because I was hiding myself from everyone else while I was in there. I mean, you know, that's a big failing of mine. I wasn't honest with my colleagues. I wasn't honest with my family and friends. I wasn't honest with the media, because I was not handling the load, the pressure well in the job. And I can't know if others didn't. But what I can tell you is that lots of people aren't contesting this next election. And I don't think it's unrelated to the experiences that I had.
And do you think if many of those who are running for election were to read this book, they might go, Jesus, I should have changed my mind. I shouldn't be running.
You know, actually, someone asked me about that. And I think if you read this book and you don't want to go into politics after reading it, then maybe you shouldn't. It's not written to put people off. But if you are thinking of going into politics, absolutely read it. And it will give you a better perspective of what you're getting yourself into. Eamon Delaney wrote a great book called An Accidental Diplomat, about the ups and downs of being a diplomat. I read it and it didn't put me off at all, even though lots of it is describing very unexciting stuff. But for the exciting stuff, I wanted to be a diplomat. And I'm hoping with this book, for the exciting stuff, the interesting stuff, people are saying, yes, I want to do this job. But just, you know, it's a tough job to do. It's very difficult today. It's very polarizing. And, you know, there's a lot you have to manage yourself.
It is ruthlessly honest, and it is also, as I've described it, wryly self-deprecating. You've given yourself enormously in it, and it is one of the best political books that I've read here in Ireland. So congratulations on it. It's called Running from Office. Eoin Murphy, thank you very much for being with us here on the programme.
Thank you.
The Last Word on Today FM.